Welcome to Media Matters, hosted by Bob McChesney. Today's program is from the archives and features Bob's appearance at the Friday Forum Series at the University YMCA in Champaign on September 24, 2010. As this is an archive program, we will not be taking phone calls during today's show. Media Matters with Bob McChesney, coming up right after Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Over the last few weeks in Egypt, a million people have taken to the streets to call for democratic reform. The Egyptian government responded by cutting off internet and most cell phone access, plunging the nation into digital darkness. As more people turned to their cell phones, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to speak out for their human rights, cutting off internet and mobile access is a new way for governments to crack down on popular political uprising. Could someone in the United States flip an internet kill switch? There is cause for concern. Senators Joe Lieberman, Susan Collins, and Thomas Carper introduced legislation in the last Congress that would give the president and the executive branch authority to cut off critical infrastructure in times of crisis. A report from Wired said that Senator Collins would reintroduce the Protect Cyberspace as a National Asset Act in this Congress. The 2010 bill said that the federal government's designation of vital internet or other computer systems, quote, shall not be subject to judicial review. Timothy Carr, campaign director of Free Press, says that if the bill was reintroduced, Congress would need to seriously address its vague language and failure to establish effective checks and balances over the executive branch.
We're very concerned that should it go forward in this Congress, they need to seriously address the language within the bill that appears to give the executive branch this overriding authority. I think there are profound First Amendment issues when you allow the executive branch the power to cut off critical infrastructure. The internet is not just critical infrastructure, it's a critical social infrastructure. It is, in the 21st century, a means by which people express themselves freely.
Carr says we have to treat open networks as fundamental to a functioning democracy.
Now, given what we saw happen last week and this week in Egypt, efforts to cut off the internet are not a good thing. If a nation tries to disable its citizens' ability to speak freely, to organize and communicate with others, it really has the potential of being a gross violation of not only our right to communicate, but our human rights as well.
Last weekend, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said that he believes internet access and the right to social network is a fundamental and basic individual right.
So if the White House really feels that way, they have to hold to that commitment. If internet access is a basic right, if the right to open networks and social networking is a basic right, then they need to oppose the language in this legislation that gives them the power to take that away.
People in Sibley and Renville counties in Minnesota just want broadband. Yet the phone and cable companies there, including Frontier Communications, have failed to connect people to high-speed internet. And hundreds of homes are stuck with slow dial-up, spotty satellite, or no internet at all. So the counties decided to do it themselves and just finished a feasibility study to build its own fiber-to-the-home network. But like every comfortable service provider about to face new competition, Frontier is pushing back against the project. The company sent a letter to Sibley County commissioners recounting other municipal broadband efforts that have struggled and is cautioning the county to rethink its efforts. Mark Erickson is a Winthrop City administrator who has spearheaded the Fiber to the Home project. He says Frontier is trying to stop the competition at any cost.
They just want to throw fear and doubt into the equation. They want to obfuscate all the issues. They want to make people think that it's Ma Bell. They know how to do these things, and municipals certainly can't.
But while Frontier doesn't want the municipality to build the network, they certainly don't want to do it themselves either, and neither do other providers. Erickson says the counties are willing to work with the companies and even help finance the network, but no one is biting.
We actually have sat down and said, please work with us, but they just haven't gotten over that hump, I guess, of wanting to work with municipals. They see us too much as the enemy and not the partner.
Erickson said he isn't daunted by Frontier's fear tactics. Instead, he's spending his time rallying local folks behind a project he says will revitalize rural America.
Well, I drove up to the county to the west last week, and I was driving along and looking at all these farm sites that dot the frozen tundra up here. What's this network going to do for them? It's going to make every one of those farmhouses relevant again. They're going to be connected to the world. They can take Chinese lessons with high-definition video real-time with folks in China because they'll have 20 megs up and 20 megs down to their home for $42 a month. Those are the kinds of things that this network will allow people to do, and I'm really excited about it.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank the Friday Forum for asking me to come and speak here today. This is an unusual and unorthodox version of Media Matters. I'm going to do all the talking during this show, and I want you all to listen carefully if you're listening over the air, because I'm going to be talking about my new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, that I wrote with John Nichols. And a week from today on the air, we're going to have John Nichols, as usual, for our two-hour pledge drive show, and one of our premiums will be The Death and Life of American Journalism. So that's what's going on the air today. Now back to my listening audience here, live and in the fresh, and thank you all for coming. I think at this point, the idea that American journalism is in a deep, profound, and existential crisis is almost passé. Anyone who stops for even a moment to consider it understands the gravity of the situation. I think what's less well understood is that such a crisis for democracy, a collapse of journalism, is also a crisis for democracy. And it can hardly be overemphasized that whether you go back to the framers of our Constitution, as John Nichols and I do in the book, be that Madison and Jefferson, or you look at all the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on the meaning of freedom of the press and the First Amendment, every single one that's taken up the issue, or you look at elementary democratic political theory, take your pick. In all of them, self-government cannot work without an informed citizenry, and that can't work without journalism. It's really that simple. So we're talking about an existential crisis, not only for journalism as we know it, and news media as we know them, we're talking about an existential crisis for constitutional rule, the rule of law, and the liberties we cherish. Now let's give some sense of the crisis we're in. How serious is the crisis of journalism? Well, there's an organization called the Pew Center, which does a great deal of research on the nature of news media and the caliber of news media around the United States, and has been doing it for decades. And just earlier this year, after our book came out, in fact, they released their detailed study of Baltimore, which is a city they've been studying for a long time. Baltimore is a fairly typical American mid to large-sized city. It has major universities, it has industry, it has declining industry, pretty much like everywhere else. And what the Pew study found in Baltimore is it looked at where does the news come from? Who produces the news of Baltimore? Where do people living in the Baltimore area learn about Baltimore? And what they discovered, to I think the surprise of a lot of new media aficionados, was that 95% of the original news stories in Baltimore in 2009 came from what are called old media. And they looked at everything. They looked at blogs. They looked at Twitter accounts for the police department. They looked at everything to see where does the original material on what's going on in Baltimore come from. 95% of it came from old media. Only 5% came from what we would call new media or digital sources. So we're still relying overwhelmingly on traditional newsrooms to cover our communities to give us what we consider news. 95% from old media, predominantly the daily newspaper of Baltimore, the Baltimore Sun. Now at that point you're saying, well, isn't that great to hear? The newspapers are still kicking butts. It's not that big of a problem after all. We can just sit back and relax. Thank God old media are faring so well. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way. The Pew study went on to determine that the amount of original news stories generated by the Baltimore Sun in 2009 was down 33% from 10 years earlier. They were doing 33% fewer original news stories than they were a decade earlier. And they went on to find that the Baltimore Sun in 2009 was doing 73% fewer news stories than two decades ago. 73% fewer original news stories than two decades ago. And basically what we discovered in our research for our book, and what I think all the other studies corroborate, is that what's happening in Baltimore is happening everywhere. What's happening in Baltimore is happening every single city in this country. We've seen a sharp drop-off in the number of working reporters from the late 1980s to today across the nation. In most cities we go to, and John and I visited probably 35 cities this year talking about this book, and went into newsrooms in almost every city. In most cities we went to, they say that there would be roughly half the number of working reporters there were in the late 1980s. In some cities, a third the number of working reporters. And in most of these cities across this country, the population has increased rather sharply in the last 20 or 25 years. So what we're seeing is dramatic cutbacks in all types of coverage. County government, which handles so much of the social services Americans depend on, particularly in times of crisis, is virtually uncovered now in the United States. It's virtually uncovered. State government has far fewer reporters than it did 10 or 20 years ago. In state capital after state capital, the large percentage of the work being done goes uncovered by traditional news media or any type of news media. Science reporting, which used to be a major and important beat that really rose and was a high watermark of professional journalism in the 1980s and into the 90s, has all but disintegrated. It's one of the first things that's gone on the chopping block with cutbacks in newsrooms. So we don't have science reporters. So when we deal with issues of public health, environmental issues, issues of nuclear waste, we don't have science reporters there who can translate complex issues to make sense for citizens so they can participate. Foreign coverage collapsed. There are very few foreign reporters connected to American newsrooms compared to what there were 10, 20, 25 years ago. And last but not least, investigative journalism has also all but disintegrated in the United States. Investigative journalism, which oftentimes requires two, three, four reporters working several months to break a single story, is entirely antithetical to the corporate model of journalism. It costs a fortune, and the worst thing about it, you might get a story out of it, right? But the worst thing for real investigative journalism to a corporate owner is you might actually have a story, and you're going to probably piss off someone the owner doesn't want to piss off. So all's better just not to have that type of journalism. Far better to have less expensive, syndicated fare that doesn't require reporters. So that's a pretty depressing picture coming out of the Pew Center study. I can see you're nodding your heads. But that's not the worst of it. That's the good news part of it. That's the, you know, first the good news. That was the good news. The bad news is when they looked at where those original news stories, what they were based on. Where did they come from? Where did the original news stories of Baltimore, why did they originate the way they did? Stories come from somewhere. And traditionally, one of the dark secrets of journalism, professional journalism, is that even at its heyday in the 1960s and 1970s and into the 1980s, at the very most prestigious newspapers in the United States, the New York Times, the Washington Post, 40 or 50% of the news stories came from what's called public relations or press releases, even at our best media. And at our best media, good reporters would interrogate them at least. They'd get the press release to do a story on it, but they'd go call someone up to fact check it, get another quote on it. They wouldn't just run it verbatim. But that was in the glory days. 40, 50% of our news stories were still based on public relations or some sort of handout from an official source. People in power saying, this is what you should be talking about in the news, and the news media saying, okay, we'll talk about it. And the other 50% coming from reporters say, this is stuff we think is important for people in the community to know, and we're going to cover this. Well, that's changed now. The Pew study demonstrates that almost 90% of the original stories in Baltimore come from public relations or press releases. 90%. And they also went on to determine that almost all of them are unchecked by a reporter, meaning they went directly from the press release, the official source, into print without passing go to collect $200, without having anyone fact check it, without having anyone get a second opinion or a third opinion, without having anyone give any context. In short, we're in a new world order of heavy public relations, heavy spin, heavy propaganda, minimal actual journalism, minimal actual credible independent reporting. And some of the research that John Nichols and I did in our book, I think, demonstrates the dilemma quite clearly. In 1960, there was one public relations agent for every working journalist in America. It was a one-to-one ratio. By 1980, the ratio had gone to 1.2 public relations people for every working journalist. This year, in 2010, the ratio is 4 public relations people for every working journalist. At current rates of change, we expect that in 2015, the ratio will be at least 8 public relations people for every working journalist. 8 people, many of whom are trying to doctor the news, influence the news, shape the news without you knowing it, surreptitiously, for everyone who's trying to consciously shape the news with their byline on it and being accountable for it. It simply can't be done. It's like asking someone to play defense with 2 players against an offense. You simply, no matter how good the players are, you just can't do it. You're going to lose, no matter what team you're playing. So what we'll have, though, is not a lack of news. We're still going to have 24-channel news cycles. We'll still have some semblance of newspapers. We'll certainly have lots of what's called news online. But we'll have very precious little journalism. What we'll have instead is a golden age of spin and propaganda, world-class spin and extraordinarily brilliant propaganda. And of course, this isn't a hypothetical situation I'm describing. This is the world we're living in right now. The frightening thing is, this is going to look like a golden age in 5 years. This year, you say, boy, wasn't that bad back in 2010? You know, that Beck, he had a couple stories right along the way. He'd stick out as positive today, much like Bill O'Reilly looks better today than he did 5 years ago in the current environment. We're heading in that direction. Now, there is going to be quality journalism for elites, especially business elites, and some of that will migrate to the web, but it will be expensive and it will be restricted. And it will be there, and some of us will be able to afford it, but many won't. Most of what is called journalism today, and going forward in the current environment, unless we make changes, could fit very comfortably in an authoritarian society without any trouble. You could see easily in the Soviet media debates over which Politburo member had the biggest butt. That would fit comfortably in Soviet media. That would not threaten Soviet social relations one iota. Or which film star in the Soviet Union had cosmetic surgery. Again, that sort of journalism does not threaten anyone in power. That does not empower citizens. We could see this sort of journalism fitting quite comfortably in societies that are basically authoritarian. Train wrecks, scandals, celebrities, the stuff that is the lion's share of what our journalism today would fit comfortably. Similarly, our political journalism, what passes for political journalism in the United States, is basically gossip, volleying between the two dominant parties and interest groups who are largely dictated over by money, and almost invariably avoiding the central issues of our time. That's the nature of what they call news today. So the two great issues that drove Thomas Jefferson and James Madison when they crafted the First Amendment and when they introduced the major subsidies that spawned journalism in the United States, the two great issues that they said you need a free press for or you cannot have a democracy are the two great weaknesses of our journalism today in the United States. The first issue, the one Jefferson emphasized, was inequality. Jefferson said, unless we have a credible free press that draws people without property into the political process, inevitably wealthy people will dominate, even if you have formal equality. People without property require journalism to be participants, otherwise they can't participate. People with property will always get the information they need. They will naturally rule unless you have a press system, empower people without property. In our media system today, people without property, those at the bottom, have largely been written off of our journalism, and that's going to be increasingly the case. Increasingly in our journalism for the past two decades or three decades, poor people only matter at all when they get in the way of rich people. Otherwise, their concerns are entirely of no concern to our news media. And then the issue that most obsessed James Madison with why we needed a free press was that we needed to have a check on an empire and militarism. Madison wrote about this endlessly. It was a central preoccupation of his throughout his life. And his most famous quote along those lines, I think I probably used it 100 times in my articles, is that no nation can remain free if it's permanently at war. No nation can remain free when it's permanently at war. Jefferson understood that even a democratic nation, if it's rich and powerful, its leaders, no matter how benign in our eyes, no matter how accountable to the electorate, will have strong pressure and temptation to become a military power, to dominate other countries. There's so many advantages that come with that, and that they will be in a world where if they don't do that, their competitors will do it, so it will not even be optional for them necessarily. And the only check on preventing militarism, permanent empire in the United States, even in a democratic country, would be to have a credible news media, an independent news media, that would keep an eye on those guys and wouldn't let them get away with it. Madison was a classical scholar. He had studied the demise of Athenian democracy, the demise of the Roman Republic, and he knew full well that empire and militarism was antithetical to democracy. Something had to go, and he did everything in his power in our Constitution, as I think many of you know, to see that we wouldn't have standing armies, that we wouldn't have presidents who could start wars without jumping through lots of hoops because of that great concern that he had. But our news media has to play a central role in doing the job of what Madison called for, and it's failed miserably in that regard. So the two most important reasons you need a credible independent free press right now are dreadful in the United States, and they're only going to get worse. They're only going to get worse. So why is that? Why are we seeing this complete disintegration of journalism? Conventional wisdom blames the internet. And there's a certain amount of value to that argument, because the internet has indeed, or is in the process, of destroying the business model for much commercial news media and for journalism. It's taking away readers, it's taking away viewers, and it's wiping out advertisers. Take newspapers, for example. 10 years ago, American Daily Newspapers got roughly $20 billion in 2000 for classified advertising, $20 billion. Today, the figure is going to be virtually nothing. almost non-existent. No one except someone who's really out of, living in a strange cave uses newspaper classified advertising anymore. It just doesn't exist. That's $20 million just erased by the internet right there. $20 billion that used to go to newspapers. That's the extreme case, but it's taking place for all advertisers. Advertisers are jumping ship, a big chunk of them. So it's true. The internet is forcing us to revisit how our journalism business model works. But the internet's not the cause of the crisis. It simply sped it along. It aggravated it. It accelerated it. And it makes it irreversible. Because the problem with that analysis is that all the negative trends I've just described to you began 3 decades ago, long before Google, long before YouTube, long before Facebook, long before Twitter. They were all strongly in place. The 1990s was a decade in which the internet had no effect whatsoever on the business models of American commercial news media, broadcast, or newspapers. Profits for the owning companies in the 1990s of American newspaper were record profits pretty much the entire decade. The population of this country boomed, advertising increased, everything was on the way up. Yet during the 1990s, our newspapers in their newsrooms, our news magazines, our radio and television news services all cut back. All cut back in resources because they could make more money doing it. And they were mostly in monopolistic markets where they could get away with it. They could make cuts and there was no one else there to pick up the slack. So monopoly corporate ownership said we can make more money gutting the newsroom in the near term and not worry about what happens down the road. And they did that, even in boom times. That was long before Google, once again. It was then, for example, that the turn to trivia became a state religion in the newsroom almost. I remember in 1994, for one of my research projects, I looked at the 10 biggest news stories that got the most attention in America in 1994, and it's a rogues gallery of asininity. I mean, it was the O.J. Simpson trial, Lorena Buttafuoco, or whatever her name was, the one who cut the penis off her husband. I forget. This is a test how many of you read the news. So you're failing it. You guys are all these inaccuracies. Who was the one? John Wayne Gacy? Bobbitt. I apologize. You get the idea. But these are like the top stories. And who was the woman who smacked the knees of the other skater? Tanya Babbitt or Harding? Whatever. You get the idea. That's what the top stories in the news in 1994, the most covered stories. So that was long before Google and YouTube and Facebook. We were already in that zone. And it was a period then, too, by the 1990s, that labor news had all but disappeared in American journalism. Whereas labor news was a dominant source of news, even in conservative anti-labor newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, in the middle of the 20th century, a standard beat everywhere in our news media was to cover the affairs of labor. By the 1990s, the beat no longer existed. Instead, it had been replaced by business news. And we had enormous business sections already by the 80s and 90s, driven purely by commercial concerns, that this is where the money was. People with money wanted business news. That's who advertisers wanted to reach. And what was the caliber of the business journalism that developed? Well, it was absolutely atrocious, absolutely atrocious. We had these enormous new business staffs of reporters and editors, business journalism schools training business reporters. They completely missed the corporate crime wave of Enron and WorldCom, completely a switch. I mean, Fortune magazine, I think, made Enron its number one company in America like 5 years in a row, something like that. These guys were totally asleep at the switch while they were getting the Treasury rated. And then the financial crisis comes along, the stock market bubble, the housing bubble, they miss it entirely, and they're still missing it to this day. So we've had this sort of commercially driven business journalism that's all but worthless, driven to try to attract the upper middle class and doing nothing but causing damage for our economy. So the best explanation, I would say, for the crisis we're in isn't just the internet, although it's accentuated it. To some extent, it's just the monopolization of the corporate news media that took place in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s that led to a high premium on shaping the news to be a profit center in the near term, reaching the desired target audiences, and doing with the content what would follow that. And also a sharp knife to make cutbacks in resources to journalism whenever and wherever possible. But even putting the matter at that level isn't really sufficient, because professional journalism at its heyday in the 60s and 70s, and that clearly was the heyday of professional journalism, was far from flawless, far from perfect. And many of our great journalists from that era, if you read their work, are the first ones to point out the weak spots in journalism from that time. Specifically on the two issues I talked about that Jefferson and Madison pointed out, the economy and foreign policy, inequality and foreign policy. Our mainstream professional journalism, even at its best in the 1960s and 70s, too often volleyed between what people in power were saying, let official sources set the range and tone of a legitimate debate, and feared to go outside of it for fear of being called unprofessional and ideological. which leads us into things like Vietnam, or leads us to a position where the civil rights movement is all but ignored until after we have deadly violent riots in our cities. So where are we now? The internet, we're told, in the new conventional wisdom, not only killed journalism, but don't worry, it's also going to solve journalism. The internet is dead, long live the internet, or journalism is dead, long live journalism. That's what we're told. Just be patient. Just be patient. The genius of free market entrepreneurial Yankee go-getter capitalism and wonderful magic science fiction technology, put that in a cocktail, throw it in the air, do a rain dance, and voila, 10 or 15 years from now, solid, we'll have a new journalism, digital, and we'll all live happily ever after. All it's going to take is a little bit of patience, and don't let that nasty old government meddle in any way. Let the free market work its magic. That's the new dominant conventional wisdom. That's what you're going to hear. That's what passes for visionary thinking today in journalism circles. That's that, you know, if you use a lot of buzzwords about technology, oh, this guy's really smart. Better yet, a PowerPoint where you show some new technology that's being invented that hasn't out yet. Boy, this guy's really on the cutting edge. But unfortunately, there's one small problem with that vision of the internet coming to solve our journalism. There's not a shred of evidence to support it yet. Not a single strand, not an iota, not a molecule, not a cell, not a nucleus, not an electron. Zippo. There is nothing to support that view. There's no empirical data. We're losing 120,000 jobs. How many jobs have replaced it on the internet now that we're shifting to our go-go digital era? Well, we could probably fit all the people who are making legitimate employment on the internet as journalists in this room. That's not going to cover America. That's not going to get the job done. Most of the journalism on the internet today still is people who get paid primarily because of old media, and it gets put online. And when their old media goes under, they're out of work. That's where it's coming from. When the Nation goes down, Don Nichols isn't going to be on the internet anymore. When the Atlantic goes down, when National Review goes down, all that material that Alternet picks up and Common Dreams picks up, it's coming oftentimes from old media, who get paid from old media. The internet itself has not come up with a magical business model to pay for journalists. Jared Lanier, who I had on my radio show earlier this year, who is the guy who invented or one of the creators of virtual reality 2 decades ago, put it best. He said, in the new digital world, the truth of the matter is that musicians, artists, creative people, and journalists are the new peasants. There is no way they're going to get support. There's not out there. It's a dream. It's a fantasy. People think you're going to find money out there to support it. Now, we're going to have bloggers. We're going to have amateurs, true. But we're going to have very few paid journalists working in competing independent newsrooms, accountable for beats that aren't fun to cover, so amateurs and volunteers aren't going to cover them, accountable for beats, with editors, fact-checkers, colleagues, resources, lawyers to back you up if you piss off someone in power, and you better. If you aren't, you're not doing journalism. Great journalism, as Ben Bagdikian said, needs great institutions. There's simply no other way you're going to have it. Great journalism needs great institutions. Now, I love amateur and citizen and pro-am journalism. I do some of it myself. I'm a blogger. I'm up there all the time, too. But I have no illusions that that can be a satisfactory journalism for a free society, that volunteer journalism. Expertise, accountability, that stuff is important. You can't live without it. We need to have paid working journalists and have bloggers and amateur journalists working together. We can't have one or the other. And if we do, we can have the greatest journalism imaginable going forward. The way John and I like to put it in our book, to imagine what we could have with journalism, is like jazz band. Imagine that the bloggers and the tweeters and the pro-ammers and all the people who are doing their own thing in their free time on the internet are like the soloist in a jazz band, and the professional journalists in newsrooms who are producing content are like the bass, drums, and piano. They're the rhythm section. Well, together you can make great music, but if you get rid of your rhythm section, the horn's probably just going to be making noise, and you're not going to want to listen to it. It's not going to be much. A great blogger needs great journalism. Glenn Greenwald is a great blogger. He does great research. I'm an enormous fan of Glenn. But his whole career is based on having other people's stuff to mine. That's what he's a genius at collating, critiquing, and sifting through what other journalists have done. If they're out of business, Glenn's up a tree or up a creek, but he's up something. He's not on the screen writing what he's writing. So what do we do? Well, we have a crisis, and it seems like we have no solution. And what John Nichols and I argue is that, in fact, we do have a solution. And the crisis is not really the crisis of journalism, but the crisis is our inability to understand it clearly. The crisis is our inability to understand it clearly. And once we actually do understand the problem of journalism clearly, there's an obvious solution. solution all other democratic nations use, the solution we did in our history to create our press system. Massive public subsidies for independent media, independent journalism. That's how other countries do it. That's how we used to do it. It's the only solution if we're going to have it again. There's no other way we're going to get there. And the point of our book is to lay this out. And what we do in the book is debunk three enormous myths that sort of are widely held that get in the way of any credible understanding the truth about our own history and the situation we face. The first myth is the government plays no role and has played no role and should play no role in media or press or journalism whatsoever. And that's the American way. That's, you know, Congress will make no law, by golly, and the government, the less it does, the better. Get off there and do nothing, because that's the American way. The second myth is that the news media in the United States has always been the domain of Wall Street, big business, the profit system, and that therefore if the system can't produce profits, well, you don't have news. It's that simple. They can't make money? Well, that's just the way it's meant to be. The free market or God, or maybe they're the same, has elected that we are not going to have journalism, so let's roll up the rug and won't have democracy. But that's the most important thing. Free market business runs journalism. If they can't make money, you're just out of luck. And the third myth is that any government subsidy of journalism at all, no matter how well-intended, inevitably and invariably puts you on an inexorable path to the Soviet Union and Pravda, Nazi Germany, or Pol Pot's Cambodia. That is just an inexorable path to the worst possible situation any human being could imagine living in before they're shot at a firing squad. Those are the three myths that we've had to deal with in this book. And I think the starting point to understanding the truth about our journalism is that journalism is not primarily a commercial undertaking. If it's thought of that way, you're never going to understand how it works. It's primarily what we call in economics a public good. It has to be understood as a public good. And what I mean by public good in lay terms, in very simple terms, is simply there's some social functions and institutions that are extremely necessary that the market will not produce in sufficient quality or quantity. The market will not and cannot produce in sufficient quality or quantity, and individual citizens can't use the market to express their desire for that public good. The market is not an effective means. Those are public goods. The public good that's usually used in textbooks that everyone understands is military defense. If we had a military defense system where government didn't do it at all, and I suspect some people in this room would be all for that, but if we had such a system, and let's say you, sir, here, you hired a company to defend your house from foreign attack, and you lived across the street from him, you said, well, that guy's house is safe, I'm not going to pay, because I know if he's covering his house, my house is probably going to be safe, I'm close enough to him. Then the next year you find out, hey, she's getting a free ride from me, I'm not going to pay this year, let her pay next year. Neither of you pay, then eventually country invades, takes over, and you both lose out. And countries figured out a long time ago, you can't do it that way. You've got to have everyone's protected or no one's protected. Everyone pays in and everyone benefits. That's the theory of a public good, and that's how military defense works in any nation. And it's not just military defense. National parks, fire departments, public education, and something of near and dear to this university's hearts, basic academic research, a classic public good, of extraordinary value, but left to the market, it would never be done. And left to the market would suffer in the long run because it relies on basic research to do applied research. So all these things only exist when the public enters through public monies and creates them. And that's what a public good is. And that's how journalism should be regarded. And the important thing, too, to remember is that people can't use the market to express their desire for public good, which is why all this sort of whining you always hear, well, people wanted journalism, they'd read the newspaper. It's their fault. They don't read it, of course it's going to go out of business. Well, that's an unfair blame to put on people. They should watch the news. If they watched the news, they'd have more of it. They should want more investigative reporting. If they wanted more, they'd have more of it. The problem with that theory is it assumes the market works, that it's a private enterprise, that it's a private good. In fact, it isn't. The problem with journalism is that final consumers, purchasers of the product, never accounted for more than a small percentage of the revenues of the field. They don't have that much control. In fact, in the case of journalism, the public good nature of it's been masked entirely because of advertising for the last 100 years. Advertising has provided between 60 and 100% of the revenues of news media in this country for the last 100 years. 50 or 60 at the very low end with magazines, 100% for broadcast news. Final consumers have never provided anywhere near a majority. They're not the ones who are to blame them. They don't have the power. It's not a private good. It's a public good. And along those lines, the public good, one of the things we did as an aside, some of the research I did a few years ago, we did focus groups of working class Americans And we asked them their attitude towards public broadcasting. Working class Americans from all ethnic backgrounds in all regions of the country. And we asked them, what do you think of public broadcasting? And what was striking about it to us was almost all of them said they strongly supported it and they were willing to pay more taxes to have more public broadcasting. And they also said they didn't watch it or listen to it. It's not for us, and we can't relate to it. But they said, we think it's really important to have, and we're willing to pay for it. We want non-commercial programming. We like the idea there's someone covering the state house because no commercial station's doing it anymore. We're willing to pay for it. And that's how people feel about journalism. People who don't consume what passes for journalism today shouldn't be criticized. I think it's a highly rational response to what passes for news. What we should be doing instead is saying, do they just want journalism? And if they can't find a way to use the marketplace to express their desire, which is the rational way to view it, and I think the accurate way. When I talk to my students, my own daughter for that matter, they aren't consuming traditional news hardly at all. Hardly at all. But are they willing to pay money, tax dollars, to make sure someone is covering the White House and the Pentagon? You bet they are. And I think that accurately reflects everyone. And that's how public goods work. That's how you have to understand it. Now, the problem for journalism, then, understood that way today, is that advertising is jumping ship. In 2009, for the very first time in its history, the New York Times had more revenue from circulation than from advertising. More revenue from circulation than advertising. Now, anyone here that knows the newspaper industry at all knows that if someone had told you that 10 years ago, it would have been a joke. You said, no, you're wrong. It's impossible to happen. Newspapers got 60 to 85% of their money from advertising. Under 50, less than circulation, unthinkable. Well, that happened. And that's going for everyone soon. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So we're now at the point now where the public good nature of journalism returns. We're now back to the point where it isn't profitable, where it doesn't make sense for business to spend money in journalism. They can't make money out of it. There's not the revenues there for it. Now, the discerning members of the audience, and I can tell most of you are probably saying to yourself, okay, smarty pants, if advertising bankrolled journalism so much for the last 100 years, and advertising didn't play a big role before that, and this country started in 1776 or 1789, pick your date, and we had the most dominant journalism in the world in the 19th century, how do you explain that one? There wasn't a lot of advertising, but we had 10 times as more newspapers per capita in the first half of the 19th century than England, France, or Canada. How do you explain that one, Mr. Smarty Pants? Well, that's what our book does. It tries to answer that question. And what we did is we went back and we looked at journalism before advertising. We looked at the origins of the press system in the United States. And to our somewhat of our surprise, we discovered that unbeknownst to most Americans, there are two great aspects of the American free press tradition. Two great aspects, not one. The first one we all know about. The first great aspect of the American element of the American free press tradition is there should be no government censorship or harassment of news media. No prior restraint, no stopping you to want to start the public eye, no government can come in and say, Belden Fields, you're going to jail if you do this. It's your right to do that. And we cherish that. That's an inviolable right for freedom of the press. The second, though, element of U.S. freedom of the press tradition, which has been lost in the era of advertising, but which was understood as the most important one in the beginning of the Republic, was that it's the first duty of the democratic state to guarantee that you have a viable independent press. That having the right to have a viable independent press and not having one is bogus. These guys weren't out to win debating wars at Oxford. They were out to build a republic that actually worked, the constitutional system. The first duty of having a free press is having one in the first place, making sure it exists. Government policies had to guarantee you actually had an independent, credible, free press system that informed people, or the right to have it was bogus. It was meaningless. It was worthless. And these guys weren't wasting their time trying to win debating wars. They're trying to set up a country. And as a result, there was no sense in the first 100 years of American history, none, that doing a free press, doing journalism was something, let's just let the rich guys see if they can make money and hope we get lucky. Let's hope these guys can make a fortune doing journalism and, you know, if we're lucky, we get a republic. If not, we'll find a king. No one talked like that. It was unthinkable for the first 100 years of American history. No one thought in those terms. Instead, it was assumed instantly there would be massive subsidies to spawn a credible, independent, uncensored press system. Massive subsidies. And the only debate was how big the subsidies would be and who, you know, how you'd structure them. That was the only debate we had for the first 100 years of American history. Only debate we had. In fact, as late as the early 20th century, Woodrow Wilson's Attorney General Burleson was criticized when he actually called postal subsidies a subsidy. He said, those aren't a subsidy, that's part of our free press tradition, he was criticized. As late as the 20th century, that's how he was criticized. So what were the subsidies? Well, the one I just talked about by far was the most important, the post office subsidy. Prior to the 1820s or 1830s, the U.S. Post Office was the distribution arm for American newspapers. That's how all newspapers were circulated. Post offices in the 19th century oftentimes delivered twice a day, sometimes three times a day, oftentimes 7 days a week. The post office was the nervous system of our country for the first 100 years. And what did the post office do? What was its primary job? Well, its primary job was delivering newspapers. That's what it did. 95% of the weighted traffic to the post office in the first half of the 19th century was newspapers. 95%. 70% of the units of the post office in the first half of the 19th century were newspapers. 70% of the units were newspapers. 95% of the weighted traffic. So the most important debate Congress had in 1792 when it met to create the post office, it was required to do by the U.S. Constitution, was what were you going to charge newspapers to be mailed? What are you going to charge these guys? Now, we would assume today, if you hadn't heard the first 40 minutes of this talk, you would assume today that, of course, the founders stood on the floor of the house in the well there, waving their copy of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and saying, these bums are paying full price. We can't interfere with market mechanisms. They have to pay the actual cost of production so we don't interfere with free markets. No free lunch, no welfare for these newspaper publishing bums. You would assume that would be the debate. No, that wasn't it. In fact, it went something like this. At one extreme position, you had those who argued that newspapers should be extremely heavily subsidized compared to other media, other forms of postage, such that a newspaper should cost one half penny to mail or 1 penny to mail compared to a normal letter, which would be 20 cents to mail, even though a normal letter would be way much less than a newspaper. That was one extreme position. This way you would subsidize, make it possible for all sorts of newspapers to exist that couldn't survive if they had to pay their actual their delivery charge. That was one extreme position. The other extreme position, that of James Madison and Benjamin Bates, Ben Franklin's grandson, was that all newspapers of all time should always be mailed for free. Any charge whatsoever for postage would be a form of censorship, because the first newspapers that would go out of business for postal charges would be the weakest ones. The weakest ones. And those were precisely the ones that free society wanted to keep alive. Because Madison was an Enlightenment figure. He thought the truth came from out there, not from power. And you kept the most dissident ideas alive, because that's invariably, from his experience, ultimately where the truth always came from. So a healthy, credible society wanted to encourage the dissident ideas, not put up any barriers to them. Well, in that debate, these guys won. Madison didn't. We'd had the heavily subsidized, but not free. And part of it was because they wanted to protect local newspapers around the country. They knew if they were completely free, the largest metropolitan papers could blow out smaller papers in cities out in the Alleghenies and Appalachians. But this became a debate in Congress for the next 100 years. Every year, every 2 years, what should they charge? And one of the great victories in American history, we should be most proud of, was in 1849, one group of papers finally got completely free postage. Now today, being cynics, we would assume that the big fat cat publishers from Philadelphia and New York took their fancy train car down to Washington or their stagecoach, loaded up with bourbon and painted women, bought off some politicians, and they got some cushy deal. That's, of course, how it works in America, right? No. That's not how it worked then. It doesn't have to work that way now either. What happened, in fact, was the one group of newspapers that got completely free postage were the smallest, weakest papers in America. Weekly newspapers, only distributed within their own little county, got free postage. And you know what group of papers fell almost entirely into that category? The abolitionist press. That was one of their main causes. They knew they needed that in order to survive. They needed to be able to distribute it for free. No one was doing IPOs in abolitionist newspapers in 1849. It wasn't like a profit center. They needed that subsidy or the movement would not be able to survive. So there were other subsidies too. I could go into that. I want to cut ahead now. But I will say this. When Tocqueville came to America to write Democracy in America, he was astounded at the breadth of our print culture. As I said, tenfold number of newspapers per capita compared to any other country in the world. And it wasn't an accident. It was a result of enlightened, brilliant public policy. We went back and figured out if the United States today subsidized as a percentage of GDP journalism to the same extent the United States government did in the 1840s. We went back and looked at all the original data. What would the federal government today have to spend to equal the federal subsidy as a percentage of GDP from the 1840s? And the number was $30 billion. $30 billion, to give some sense. Now, one last point on this is that, you know, we were wondering when we were doing this research, well, maybe, okay, that's an interesting history, but a lot of people say, okay, that's ancient history, man. That was before America was really America. You know, we didn't have pizza or pro football or rock and roll. I mean, suburbs, cars, I mean, that doesn't count. You know, we take a mulligan on the 19th century. Clearly, when the Supreme Court visited, they factored in that non-newspaper media is a commercial enterprise, and that the interests of commercial owners are what's paramount if we're going to have a free society. So we went back and we reread all the Supreme Court decisions on freedom of the press in the 20th century that took up this issue. And there's only about seven or eight really central cases in that regard. And what was striking, including opinions written recently by Reagan and Nixon appointees to the Supreme Court, stated conservatives, what was striking about reading these Supreme Court decisions was that they all pretty much embraced the Madison-Jefferson view. They all embraced the idea that the freedom of the press is a social right we all have. And as Potter Stewart, the First Amendment clause of the freedom of the press clause in the First Amendment is what he called, with his emphasis, a structural requirement on the government of the United States, a structural requirement. You have to have the press system or else you can't have the system work. It's a structural requirement. And so the Constitution's on our side, the Supreme Court's on our side in this issue. Well, can subsidies work? Can we make them work? And here, I think there's a lot of empirical evidence to look at. What we discovered was, on a per capita basis, if the United States subsidized public media and journalism as much as other democratic nations in the world today, all across Western Europe, and including Japan, we would have to spend today roughly $20 to $35 billion annually, as opposed to the $400 million we spend on public broadcasting. So we spend almost nothing compared to every other democratic nation. Now, again, most Americans, that is going to touch a raw nerve. You're going to say, my God, $20, $35 billion of government spending to support public media, to support journalism, those countries must be dungeons. Those countries must be absolute totalitarian hellholes, places like Sweden and Finland and France and Denmark and Holland. So what we wanted to do is, well, this, you know, I've been abroad, my wife's Norwegian, I've been there, and I confess I never thought it was a police state. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a policeman in Norway while we're out, while I think about it. But let's just, you know, I wanted to engage this as a very serious issue. So we went to look at a couple studies that have been done of the levels of democracy. One of them was done by a publication called The Economist magazine, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, a wonderful news magazine, very politically pro-business, what would be called neoliberal, very pro-market, pro-corporate. And it does an annual study called the Democracy Index, and it ranks the countries of the world on what, how democratic they are from The Economist magazine's criteria. And those are, most of the criteria are standard political science criteria. How much civil liberties there are, voter participation, how much little corruption there is in governance, things like that. But also they have some of their business stuff is in there too. So that Economist magazine ranks all the countries in the world and how democratic they are. And you know what was interesting? We went through the last several years of the Democracy Index. You know who counted for the top four or five countries every year in the Economist magazine's Democracy Index? The countries with the largest journalism subsidies in the world. Sweden, Denmark, Finland, the Netherlands, always. Top countries, one through five, every year. So we said, okay, well, maybe the Economist had a rough go there, rough day. Maybe they got a rejuggle their criteria. Maybe they're missing some level of authoritarianism that we're not familiar with. So what we did is we went and we looked at another group called Freedom House. Freedom House is a group that was established in the Cold War, and its sole mission was to monitor government harassment of private commercial news media around the world. It was a very strong anti-communist, anti-authoritarian group. And every year, it ranks every country in the world on the level of freedom of the press that country enjoys, level of freedom of the press. And that's all based on how much government harassment there is of private media. That's their criteria. That, you know, they're zeroed in on that baby. So any communist country automatically goes in the unfree press category. Any dictatorship, unfree press. To show how sensitive the antenna of Freedom House are, even a country like Venezuela, which has a hugely dissident press that's operating openly and without being locked up, even Venezuela is in the unfree press zone because the government has said, says sort of critical things about it, and that has a chilling effect that can hamper the freedom of press in the country. So Venezuela, too, has an unfree press. So these guys are really watching it. They're hawking it, right? If there's any government hanky-panky, they're going to catch it. So where does the United States rank, according to Freedom House, in terms of freedom of the press? Well, we rank 21st in the world. And guess what? You know, I think you're going to know, based on this lecture, where this is going. Guess who the top five countries are in Freedom House's freest, private, most uncensored commercial news media in the world are? The same countries with the highest public broadcasting and journalism subsidies. Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, Belgium, whatever, the works. It's just right down the list. It's astonishing. And the moral of the story is that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have public subsidies like we did in our history and not have government censorship and government control. They just have to be enlightened subsidies. We did it. Other countries are doing it. And unless we do it, we're not going to get anywhere close to them. We're heading in the wrong direction. In fact, all the research now on European press subsidies shows the larger they are, the more adversarial the press becomes towards the government, because the more freedom they feel they've got, that they can take chances because they've got a subsidy. They don't have to worry about going under or getting crushed. So it can be done. Now, we'd like to have $30 billion to do the job. I think that'd be just about the right number. That's what it took in the 1840s to build journalism in America, and that's what these countries are paying in their, on a per capita rate in their countries. And I know that's awfully tough to say, you know, spend $30 billion in journalism. After all, we need to spend that every couple weeks in Afghanistan for God knows what reason, or in Iraq or whatever. So let's say we aren't going to raise taxes or even spend that money. We could just take existing money we misallocate and reallocate it and solve a lot of the problem. We currently spend, we don't know the exact number, we're working on this right now, but many billions of dollars just on government public relations. Many billions of dollars on government PR, mostly military, trying to influence the news. Well, instead of doing that, since there's no news to influence, why don't you scrap most of that and just give the money to create independent journalism and actually tell the truth rather than just PR? So right there, we can start with like $4 or $5 billion that we play with, get us going. That's money gets you in the game. That's your ante. Another place we could go, commercial broadcasters get their monopoly licenses to do radio and TV for free. And the reason they get it is they claim they serve the public interest. And that's just, they aren't just normal businesses out to maximize profit. Instead, they're making onerous sacrifices for us, serving our public interests. So they're reducing their profits on our behalf. And that's why they're entitled to these monopoly licenses. And don't kid yourself, these licenses are still worth a lot of money because they're converting that bandwidth to all sorts of digital uses now. So this bandwidth has more value than ever. Don't think these stations aren't worth anything. They might not be worth as much as broadcasting, but the spectrum is worth a ton. Well, last year, the Commercial Broadcaster Trade Association estimated that the value of public service all these broadcasters were doing to justify getting these free monopoly licenses was roughly $9 billion. I confess that in the past, I've been skeptical about their arithmetic. Didn't quite think it added up to $9 billion. Thought it added up a lot closer to zero. But I'm a magnanimous guy. I'm a big-hearted guy. I say, okay, let bygones be bygones. I'll take you at your word. You've been spending $9 billion out of your pocket in public service. I'll make a deal with you. You cut us a check for $5 billion, and you can pocket the other $4 billion and do whatever you want there. Stop doing all that great public service programming you're doing. Do whatever you want on your commercial stations. We'll take the $5 billion and put it towards nonprofit, non-commercial, independent media in this country. So right there, we've got $10 billion. For $10 billion, people can get a taste of real journalism again. We could have enough money to have newsrooms. We could have enough money. Well, where would the money go? Well, here's a number of places it should go. For starters, we need vastly more money for public broadcasting, radio and TV, and community media. We have to stop thinking of non-commercial broadcasting as a monolith. We can have non-profit, non-commercial competition between newsrooms, between stations, and it can be healthy. And on that note, those of you listening to this over the air, remember 1 week from today is the pledge drive, and we'll be trying to raise money for this station, WILL. Please do call. We'll need your support. But we also need the government to pay for it. We can't just have pledge drives to support journalism. That's not going to be enough. We need more student media. Part of the crisis is that student journalism has plummeted in this country, especially at the high school level. People have stopped being producers. All the research shows that people do journalism, they get into it, they consume it, they become producers, they care about it, they get involved politically, they get involved socially. Journalism is a plus. Another thing we have to do is face up to the fact that this is the worst labor market for young people, probably for journalists in American history. Being a college graduate in 1933 as a journalism major probably was a golden age of employment compared to what a kid faces today who finishes with a college degree in journalism. These are the absolute dark ages. We're about to lose an entire generation of young people who want to do journalism. We've got to come up with a program like Teach for America, but call it Write for America, and take 10 or 20,000 college graduates, give them a 1 or 2 year stipend to go around the country working for nonprofit and non-commercial media, get in the game, do journalism, get some experience, and get our communities covered that are entirely uncovered now, and get them experience. We need to slash our postage for publications to make it extremely low again, so all these publications that we depend on the internet for their material can stay, have a business model at least for another 5 or 10 years so they can figure out a way to survive down the road. Buy them some time. We've got to figure out a way to convert daily newspapers to nonprofit and low-profit model with tax breaks and tax credits for reporters. I could go on and on. I'm not going to. I'm just going to stop there for now. We can talk about more of this in the question and answer period. But I do want to just conclude with a few points. It was how the response to the book so far From scholars, I'm delighted to say, who study this matter, I think there's tremendous movement in our direction, not because our ideas are so brilliant, but because there's no alternative. The evidence points pretty sharply in this area. No one's come up with a credible alternative explanation. But we still have a ways to go. From politicians, I'm delighted to say, there's actually been much more interest in this than you could possibly imagine. Both the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commissions are holding formal hearings on the journalism crisis and looking at sweeping reform proposals. And I've submitted testimony and talked to both those groups in Washington. Congress has set up an informal, possibly formal study of the journalism crisis, but of course, for political reasons, it's not being talked about a whole lot right now. As for journalism schools, I'm afraid that's been one of the disappointing parts of the story. John Nichols and I probably talked at about 20 journalism schools and communication programs. And while there were sympathetic faculty at the leading schools, I think that the administration is so closely tied to the industry, so joined to the hip, it's very hard for them to think outside of that relationship and to think creatively. But what's striking when you go to journalism schools is the kids, the students. The young people who want to be journalists really want to be journalists. We have more journalism majors in some departments than ever, in some departments now than we have ever had in those schools before. There are hundreds of kids who want to be journalists in lots of schools, all over the place, and they're talented, and they want to do it for the right reason. Obviously, if you want to be a journalist today, it's not because you want to get rich. That's not the motivation. It's because you believe in it and you care about it. And then I'm honored to say that one of the things John Nichols and I got from journalists themselves is the Newspaper Guild, the print journalist union in Washington, gave John and me their Freedom Award for our book, for this book, saying it's what's necessary to save journalism in this country. So we've had a range of opinions. There was one group that we were very disappointed in, though, in the response, and that was political conservatives. If you read the book, we did not write this book as a let's get rid of Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck, aren't they idiots, and replace them with Keith Olbermann and Bill Moyers. That's not the tenor of the book at all. It's not an ideological argument whatsoever. It's about more resources for competing independent newsrooms. That's what it's all about. And it wouldn't affect Bill O'Reilly or Glenn Beck, their job, their livelihood at all, or Sean Hannity, any of them. And we wrote it in such a way, let me preface this. At one time, about 3 years ago, I ghost wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. I ghost wrote it for the publisher of The Nation and the National Review. So I'd worked with both of them when I wrote it. It was on postal rates. And I had a great relationship with the National Review guy. He was actually very thoughtful, very smart. And so we wrote this book with that guy in mind. Said, you know, this is an argument he ought to get. He's a sort of a Tory. He'll understand the importance of civil society. And I would say the biggest disappointment was that what we thought would be a principled conservative response didn't appear. It got buried under sort of the Glenn Beck, well, Bob McChesney wants to take over the media and lock everyone up and force them to read his books and, you know, create Paul Potts, you know, Nirvana world or something. But I'm optimistic in general. The times now seem difficult politically, but I think if you were in my shoes and had talked to the people I've spoken to for the last 6, 7, 8 months about this book and saw the young enthusiasm and concern and the really great concern among working journalists, this is a problem that's not going to go away, but it's going to be met with resistance. It's going to be met with passion, and I think we will win eventually. Thank you very much.